So we are in the book of Numbers. It's the fourth book in the Bible. Quick review as we get going. Genesis, the first book of the Bible, takes us through four major events and four major people. It takes us from creation to Joseph, if you will, a period of about 2,200 years. The call of Abraham from Ur of the Chaldees, which would be present-day Iraq, into the land of Canaan, which would be present-day Israel, and then under Joseph from Canaan down into Egypt. And that takes us to the book of Exodus, where they were about 400 years as slaves, and then under Moses, he would bring them out of Egypt and down to Mount Sinai, where Moses would receive the law of God and also receive the instructions on how to build the tabernacle, which was the place where they would come to worship God. And then continuing on at Mount Sinai, we came to the book of Leviticus, which gave us the instructions on how to approach a holy God and how to walk with a holy God. And so in Leviticus, you have the introduction to the sacrificial system and also the mediation of the priests and then the various laws on how they would continue to live before God, and of course the feast days that were spoken of in the book of Leviticus. Then we come to the book of Numbers, and basically what you have in the book of Numbers is their wanderings in the wilderness. We're ready to leave Mount Sinai. We've been at Sinai for a little over a year, and we're ready to head to the promised land. And Deuteronomy chapter 1 tells us that it's an 11-day journey from Mount Sinai to the promised land, and yet it took them 40 years to get there. And the reason it took them 40 years is basically because of unbelief. God said he would go in and fight their battles, and they were too afraid of the people that lived in the promised land to go in and take the promised land. And so they ended up dying in the wilderness and wandering in that wilderness for some 40 years. So that's what the book of Numbers covers, is basically that 40-year wandering in the wilderness. What we're going to look at tonight as we look at the first 14 chapters is the preparation to head out on the march and go from Mount Sinai all the way up to the border of the promised land and the sending in of the 12 spies and the report that they bring back. The book of Numbers is so called because there are two numberings in the book. There's a census in the beginning and one at the end. In the beginning, they're numbering that generation, the males 20 years old and above who are fit to go out to battle, and then they'll number them again for the next generation that's about ready to go into the promised land under the leadership, ultimately under the leadership of Joshua. So let's go ahead and jump into this as we look at chapter 1, verse 1 of the book of Numbers. Now the Lord spoke to Moses in the wilderness of Sinai, in the tabernacle of meeting, on the first day of the second month, in the second year, after they had come out of the land of Egypt, saying, take a census of all the congregation of the children of Israel by their families, by their fathers' houses, according to the number of names, every male individually, from 20 years old and above, all who are able to go to war in Israel. You and Aaron shall number them by their armies. And with you there shall be a man from every tribe, each one the head of his father's house. These are the names of the men who shall stand with you, from Reuben. And then he goes on to list who the representative will be from each of the 12 tribes as they get ready to number the people that are there. Now, when you look at the actual numbering of them, after they pick the leaders of the 12 tribes, then you have them actually numbering the 12 tribes. So you can look at verse 20 of chapter 1, and it says, now the children of Reuben, Israel's oldest son, and you jump down to verse 21, those who were numbered of the tribe of Reuben were 46,500. And then verse 22, from the children of Simeon. And then you just make your way through to Gad and to Judah and so forth. How many of you read these chapters, by the way, going into it? Okay. All right. God bless you for that. Okay. We're just going to kind of summarize this. We're going to jump to verse 46 of chapter 1. And it says, all who were numbered were 603,500. And 50. And so we've got the totals up on the screen of what each tribe was, and the overall total, 603,550. By the way, if you are not in this room right now and you're listening to this any other way, you can go to our website at ccborrego.com and be able to see these slides. Or if you're listening to an archived version down the road, you can also go and under the teachings page be able to see all of the slides that I'm pulling up in PDF format. Now, if you notice, of the 12 tribes of Israel, one of the tribes is actually missing, and it's the tribe of Levi. Levi wasn't numbered because the Levites, the descendants of Levi, were to take care of the tabernacle. They were not to go out to war. And so you say, wait a minute, that makes 13 tribes then, doesn't it? And the answer is yes, it does make 13 tribes. But there were only 12 sons of Jacob. And so how do you have 13 tribes from 12 sons of Jacob? And the answer is that Joseph, notice Joseph's not up on the list, but two of Joseph's sons are on the list, Ephraim and Manasseh, top right column. So Joseph received the double portion, if you will. Okay, he was Jacob's favorite son, and he received the double portion. So really two tribes are allotted to his family, if you will. And so that gives you the 12 on the list with Levi left over to be able to serve at the tabernacle. And so here we have the tribes numbered in chapter 1. And then in chapter 2, we see how they were to care for the camp. How they were to camp, and specifically who would camp where of all of these tribes, who would camp where in relation to the tabernacle, which would be in the middle of the camp, and also how they would break camp. Whenever they broke down the tent and would begin to move, well, who would go first? Would they go in just a big disorderly mess as they went, or would they go systematically? And that's how they would move, would be systematically as they would move from place to place. So we look at chapter 2, beginning from verse 1, and it says, "And the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, every one of the children of Israel shall camp by his own standard or his own banner. Beside the emblems of his father's house, they shall camp some distance from the tabernacle of meeting." And now he goes on to list which tribes should camp where. So verse 3, on the east side, toward the rising of the sun, would be the tribe of Judah. And then as you go down, you would see in verse 5 that with Judah also on the east side would be the tribe of Issachar. And as you move down to verse 7, you would see also with Judah and Issachar would be the tribe of Zebulun. Okay, and so you would have of these 12 tribes, you would have three tribes on each side of the tabernacle, on the east, west, north, and south. And so he goes through in chapter 2, and he says, this is where you're supposed to camp with your tribe and on what side and so forth. And so you have them in groups of three. And so if we just look at, again, the summation of it all, you have Judah as the main tribe here camping on the east side with Issachar and Zebulun. And you can see they total a little over 186,000. And then the next triplet would be Reuben with Simeon and Gad. So you have 151,000. And then Ephraim, Manasseh, and Benjamin, 108,000. And then Dan, Asher, and Naphtali, 157,000. And so you've got the numberings. Hey, the book of Numbers. You've got the numberings of the children of Israel and how they're supposed to camp around the tabernacle. And so this gives you an idea with the main tribe listed, Judah on the east, and again, two other tribes with Judah, Reuben on the south, Ephraim on the west, Dan on the north. And now, I don't know if you can read it from where you're at, but in the middle where it's got the tabernacle there, it says Levi. And then in smaller print, you can see the Kohathites, the Gershonites, and the Merarites. And these guys, Gershon, Kohath, and Merari, they were three sons of Levi. So the tribe of Levi is divided into three of Levi's sons who've already lived and died, okay? But the people who descend back through that son would camp according to that family group. And they would be, you know, on the various sides of the tabernacle. And then Moses and Aaron, who are also from the tribe of Levi, and Aaron's sons would camp on the eastern side of the tabernacle. And so they had a lot of structure to it when you think about it as far as where they would be in relation to the tabernacle. And that brings us up to chapter 3, where we see the sons of Levi. Again, they weren't to go out to battle, but they were to care for the tabernacle, and we see how they're divided up into the three sons of Levi in verse 17 of chapter 3, where it says, "These were the sons of Levi by their names, Gershon, Kohath, and Merari." And then throughout chapter 3, you see not only where they camped, but also what their duties were. Okay, so they're in charge of the tabernacle. Gershon camped on the west, and he was in charge of carrying the tent and the curtains. So all of the curtains and the covering and the curtain around the outer courtyard, Gershon was entrusted with that. And there were about 2,000 per, okay? There were about 22,000 Levites, but when you came just to the males who would be helping the priests, there were about a little over 8,000. So there was about 2,000 roughly per group. So carrying the tent, if you will, would be Gershon and company, or the descendants of Gershon. And then the Kohathites, they would camp on the south, and they would carry the furniture of the tabernacle. They would carry the Ark of the Covenant. They would carry the golden lampstand and the table of showbread and so forth. And then the descendants of Merari would camp on the north, and they would carry the framework of the tabernacle, the boards and so forth. Okay, and so they each had their duties. And then Moses and Aaron, it mentions in chapter 3, would also camp on the eastern side. And of course, they had the duty of the priesthood and Moses being the leader of Israel. I wanted to pull one thing out as we move from this slide, and that is notice the numbers. You've got on the eastern side, on the bottom, the largest group under Judah and the other two tribes, 186,000. And then you go up to the very top, and you have the smallest group at the very top, 108,000 under Ephraim. And then on the two sides, south and north, Reuben and Dan, they're fairly balanced, aren't they? And so if you were to take an aerial view of what this looked like, some 2 million people camping in the wilderness, you've got a proportion that's something like that with the tabernacle being in the center. Only Chuck Missler could come up with something like that, okay? But I thought that was very cool and wanted to point that out to you to see how God would look down at his people. And again, him dwelling in the center of the camp. Now, as we get into chapter 4, we see how the Levites were to break down and carry the tabernacle. And I'm just going to be talking through some of these passages, the service of Kohath, Gershon, and Merari, how they would carry different how they would break down the tabernacle and take it forth. And again, of these three sons, Kohath had the furniture, Gershon the curtains, and Merari, they were in charge of the boards. Okay, so again, we're getting the foundation, the preparation ready to head out from Mount Sinai to the Promised Land. We come to chapter 5, and we have various regulations that are put in here. In the first four verses, those who are unclean, who have leprosy, certain discharges, that they're to be put out of the camp until they are clean ceremonially. In verses 6 through 10 of chapter 5, we have the restitution for sin. And then in the remainder of chapter 5, verses 11 through 31, it's an interesting law called the law of jealousy. And that's where a man, if he became jealous of his wife, like if his wife had cheated on him, then he would take his wife to the priest, and the priest would take a cup of water and take some dirt from the tabernacle floor and put it in the cup and stir it up and then write the curse if she was guilty of unfaithfulness and scrape that off in the cup. And then the woman would drink the bitter water that's in the cup. And if she was unfaithful, then her thigh would rot. If she wasn't unfaithful, then she just had to drink the bitter water and she would be okay. And you just hope you were not married to a jealous husband, I guess, you know. But this was the interesting law of jealousy that we have in chapter 5. We move into chapter 6 and we have the Nazirite vow. How many of you have heard of the Nazirite vow or a Nazirite? In chapter 6, let's look at the first couple of verses. It says, "Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, 'Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when either a man or woman consecrates an offering to take the vow of a Nazirite, to separate himself to the Lord.'" Now, what is the vow of a Nazirite? He's going to go on to explain the specifics of what a Nazirite would do. Look at verse 4. It says, "All the days of his separation, he shall eat nothing that is produced by the grapevine, from seed to skin." Verse 5, "All the days of the vow of his separation, no razor shall come upon his head." Verse 6, "All the days that he separates himself to the Lord, he shall not go near a dead body." And so with this particular vow, you wouldn't eat anything from the grapevine. So no raisins, no grapes, no wine. You wouldn't cut your hair during the time of the vow, and you couldn't be contaminated by a dead body. Now, you can see about three different folks that have taken the Nazirite vow in the Bible. Before I tell you who they are, does anybody want to guess who one of them is? Samson, right? He's the most famous, and undoubtedly we'll be stopping at Samson as we go through the book of Judges. And he seems to have been a Nazarite from the very beginning for his life. And yet, when you look at what he wasn't supposed to do, it seems like this is what Samson was doing throughout his life, unfortunately. Also, John the Baptist, one who was under the Nazarite vow. And Paul the Apostle, we read in the book of Acts, took the Nazarite vow for a period of time as well. In fact, we read there of how he took it and had his head shaved and so forth. And in chapter 6, we find that when the vow of the Nazarite is fulfilled, that they were supposed to cut their hair and then offer their hair upon the altar before the Lord. At the end of chapter 6, we have the priestly blessing. If you want to turn to chapter 6, verse 22, it says, "And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to Aaron and his sons, saying, this is the way you shall bless the children of Israel. Say to them, the Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. So they shall put my name on the children of Israel and I will bless them." Isn't that beautiful? The priestly blessing in Numbers chapter 6. Well, we come to chapter 7 and we have offerings from the leaders of the tribes. And one of the things that they would bring is they would bring carts and oxen for the Levites so that they could carry the tabernacle on carts and being pulled by oxen. And so Gershon and Merari got carts, a certain amount of carts and a certain amount of oxen to be able to pull the framework for the tabernacle, and also the curtains would be placed on those. But Kohath, they wouldn't get any carts because they were carrying the furniture and they were supposed to carry them on their shoulders, okay? Can't take that stuff and put it on a cart. They needed to carry it on their shoulders. It's interesting to think about when David was going to bring up the Ark of the Covenant, it says that he put it on a new cart. You remember that? He was doing the right thing the wrong way. He was wanting to bring God's presence into the camp, but he wasn't going about it the way it says to do it here. And so as they were on their way, they hit some rough road, and Uzzah leaned back to steady the Ark, and God struck him dead. And so we see the right way to bring up the Ark of the Covenant here. They were to carry it on their shoulders. And so the various leaders bringing various offerings that would be used in the tabernacle. And then at the end of chapter 7, we see how God would speak to Moses from above the mercy seat. Now in chapter 8, we see the Levites ceremonially cleansed and dedicated for service. Previously, we've seen Aaron and his sons consecrated for service, but now it's the Levites, okay, the tribe that's set apart and dedicated for the service, because they're the ones that are going to assist Aaron and his sons, the priests. In the first few verses of chapter 8, we see how Aaron was to arrange the lampstand, but then the bulk of the chapter is focusing on the Levites and them being set apart for service. That brings us to chapter 9. I'm not going to do this all night. I'm just trying to get to the narrative of what we're going to be reading. In chapter 9, we have the Passover celebrated. And this is, again, 1 year out of Egypt. And so remember, the Passover itself was God bringing Israel out of Egypt. And it was to be a memorial. It was to be a holiday that they would look back and celebrate. So herein we've come to a year out, and they're going to celebrate this holiday, the Feast of the Passover. Unfortunately, there were some that were ceremonially unclean, and they wanted to celebrate it too. And so Moses sought the Lord, and he got provision to have them celebrate it on the second month while everybody else celebrated it on the first month. We also find that the cloud that would be over the tabernacle would guide them throughout their journeys. If you look at chapter 9, beginning from verse 15, it says, "Now on the day that the tabernacle was raised up, the cloud covered the tabernacle, the tent of the testimony. From evening until morning, it was above the tabernacle like the appearance of fire. So it was always, the cloud covered it by day and the appearance of fire by night. Whenever the cloud was taken up from above the tabernacle, after that, the children of Israel would journey. And in the place where the cloud settled, there the children of Israel would pitch their tents." And so this is how they knew whether to move. The cloud that was over the tabernacle by day, or the pillar of fire that was over it by night, whenever it lifted up and began to move, Then they started to break down camp, and they would follow. They would march through the wilderness to follow where God was leading them. And whenever that cloud settled, then they would set up the tabernacle, and they would pitch camp just like we were talking about. So are you ready to leave Mount Sinai and get on with the march? Well, this is where we go as we move into chapter 10. It says in chapter 10, verse 1, "And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, make two silver trumpets for yourself. You shall make them of hammered work. You shall use them for calling the congregation and for directing the movement of the camps." And so, two trumpets to blast to hundreds of thousands of people so that they could hear when it was time to come. And when it was time to march and how to march. They were also used to call the people together for war. And so this was their means of communication at this time. And then we see the order of the march. Jump to chapter 10, verse 11, where they actually start heading out. It says, "Now it came to pass on the 20th day of the second month in the second year that the cloud was taken up from above the tabernacle of the testimony. And the children of Israel set out from the wilderness of Sinai on their journeys. Then the cloud settled down in the wilderness of Paran." So they started out for the first time according to the commandment of the Lord by the hand of Moses. And then we see the march of the camp, verse 14. "The standard of the camp of the children of Judah set out first." And then remember, camped with Judah was, verse 15, the tribe of Issachar, and verse 16, the tribe of Zebulun. Okay, then verse 17, "Then the tabernacle was taken down. And the sons of Gershon and the sons of Merari set out carrying the tabernacle." So you have three tribes going out, paving the way, and now you've got the tabernacle following behind with Gershon and Merari, the ones that were taking the framework and the curtains. And then in verse 18, we see the second group going out, the tribe of Reuben. And remember, with Reuben was Simeon, verse 19, and also Gad, verse 20. And then in verse 21, it says, "Then the Kohathites set out carrying the holy things. The tabernacle would be prepared for their arrival." And so it's kind of cool. You've got tribes moving out, and then you have the tabernacle broken down, and then you have the framework and the curtains going, and then you have another three tribes going out. And then in the midst of all of the tribes, you've got the furniture of the tabernacle so that when they get to where they're going, the tabernacle will be set up, and they can just move the furniture into the tabernacle. And then we have the other tribes mentioned in verse 22, Ephraim. And with Ephraim, verses 23 and 24, Manasseh and also Benjamin. And then in verse 25, the tribe of Dan. And with them, verse 26, Asher. And verse 27, Naphtali. Verse 28, "Thus was the order of march of the children of Israel according to their armies when they began their journey." And so this is kind of a visual of that. And again, it's kind of fine print, but you can see on the left-hand side how they are camped by tribes of three around the tabernacle. Then on the right-hand side, how they're to break camp. Start from the very bottom right-hand corner, and you've got the tribe of Judah with Issachar and Zebulun. They'll head out first. And then the tabernacle is taken down, and you have the Gershonites and the Merarites going out with the framework and the curtains. And then you've got Reuben, Simeon, and Gad following behind them. And then you've got the tabernacle, or the furnishings of the tabernacle under the Kohathites, again, right in the middle of the children of Israel, and then the other six tribes coming behind. So that when the Kohathites get there with the furniture, the tabernacle will be set up and they'll be able to bring it on in. And so this is the orderly way that they would march through the wilderness going from Mount Sinai to the Promised Land. Not in chaos or in disorder, but going in order. Now, the bottom half of chapter 10, Moses invites his father-in-law to go with them. His father-in-law declines at this point. We come into chapter 11. We've just started the march. These are good days. You know, we're heading to the promised land that God has promised his people. Chapter 11, verse 1. "Now when the people complained, it displeased the Lord, for the Lord heard it, and his anger was aroused. So the fire of the Lord burned among them and consumed some in the outskirts of the camp." Doesn't go without saying that this was not a good start to the journey. We've got trouble already. Look at verse 4. It says, "Now the mixed multitude who were among them yielded to intense craving. Now, the mixed multitude is referring to the fact that it wasn't just the Hebrews that left Egypt. There were Egyptians that left with them that wanted to follow the God of Israel. In fact, there were some intermarriages that took place as well among the Hebrews and the Egyptians. And so you have this mixed multitude that is influencing in a very negative way the children of Israel. So again, verse 4, the mixed multitude who were among them yielded to intense craving. So the children of Israel also wept again and said, "Who will give us meat to eat? We remember the fish which we ate freely in Egypt, the cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, and the garlic. We forgot all about the 400 years of slavery." Verse 6, "But now our whole being is dried up. There is nothing at all except this manna before our eyes." You guys remember what the manna is? That's the food that God provided. Okay, and it refers to it in the Psalms as angels' food. It says in verse 7, "Now the manna was like coriander seed, and its color like the color of bdellium. The people went about and gathered it, ground it on millstones or beat it in the mortar, cooked it in pans and made cakes of it, and its taste was like the taste of pastry prepared with oil. And when the dew fell on the camp in the night, the manna fell on it." I tell you, I love my breads, and it would probably be good, you know, especially if it was all the nutrients that you needed to be sustained. And so this is what God was giving them to sustain them, and the people were complaining. And it's funny, isn't it, how they only could remember the good of Egypt, and they didn't remember the bondage that they were in. And sometimes that's a temptation, you know. You remember the good, maybe, of the world, and you forget about the bondage that we once were in. So anyway, as they're continuing on here, the people complain and they long for Egypt, and it's a heavy load for Moses to carry. And so he goes before the Lord and he has his own mode. I don't think I would call it complaining, but he's like, "Lord, there's like 2 million plus people, and I've got a lot of them being a bunch of whiners. What am I going to do?" And what the Lord basically does is says, you know, "Take 70 of the people, of the leaders, of the elders, and we're going to delegate some of the responsibility here to help you out." And so that's what we see in verse 16 of chapter 11, where it says, "So the Lord said to Moses, 'Gather to me 70 men of the elders of Israel, whom you know to be the elders of the people and officers over them. Bring them to the tabernacle of meeting that they may stand there with you. Then I will come down and talk with you there. I will take of the spirit that is upon you and will put the same upon them, and they shall bear the burden of the people with you, that you may not bear it yourself alone." And so, delegating the responsibility. 70 of the leaders there, the elders that you know to be elders. I mean, there would be leaders of the different tribes and family clans, but he's saying you'll know the ones that, well, that are probably showing forth that leadership quality. Take those guys, bring them, and now God's Spirit upon these 70. So it's not just one, it's now 71 that can be able to minister to these people and help guide them through the time as they make their way into the promised land. And so the elders are commissioned, and these guys are, you know, these other guys are longing for the meat that they had in Egypt. And so God said, "I'll give you the meat. You know, you want it, here it comes." Look at the end of verse 18. It says, "Therefore, the Lord will give you meat, and you shall eat," verse 19, "you shall eat not one day, nor 2 days, nor 5 days, nor 10 days, nor 20 days, but for a whole month until it comes out of your nostrils and becomes loathsome to you, because you have despised the Lord who is among you and have wept before him, saying, 'Why did we ever come up out of Egypt?'" And so God is going to bring them the meat, but it's not going to be a pretty picture. People are going to eat the meat, and let's see what happens in verse 32. It says, "The people stayed up all that day." You see, God brought quail is how he did it, and he brought a ton of quail, and I'm not exaggerating there, much more than that. The people stayed up, it says, all that day, all night, and all the next day, and gathered the quail. He who gathered least gathered 10 homers. Everybody knows what a homer is, right? I was looking at my notes. 10 homers would equal 15 33-gallon trash cans, okay? The one who gathered least gathered 15 trash cans full of quail, all right? So this is how much meat. They, you want it, You got it. Here you go. And it shows here, when they were gathering it, it just shows the hoard mentality, doesn't it? It doesn't show the, oh, God, I'm good with just whatever you want to give me. No, it's like, ah, I want it all for me. And so it just, you know, they're up that day, all night, all the next day. And they spread them out for themselves all around the camp. Verse 33, but while the meat was still between their teeth, before it was chewed, the wrath of the Lord was aroused against the people, and the Lord struck the people with a very great plague. So he called the name of that place Kibroth Hatava, because there they buried the people who had yielded to craving. From Kibroth Hatava, the people moved to Hazeroth and camped at Hazeroth. And so, you know, some people say this, but I think there's an element of truth to it. You got to be careful for what you ask for, you know? I mean, they wanted and they lusted after that, which they shouldn't have been wanting. Psalm 106, verse 15 says, and he gave them their request, but sent leanness into their soul. And when we allow ungodly cravings to rule our lives, sometimes we might just get what we ask for, but it will be leanness to our soul. I think what we want more is a fat soul and be deprived of the things that we shouldn't have. Now, notice they're leaving this place, Kibroth Hatava, and are coming to Hazeroth. Here's a kind of a cool map here that we can take a look at their travel. If you look at the blue number one, that's Israel leaving Egypt and coming to Mount Sinai, and that's where we've been for a couple of weeks as they've received the law and so forth. The yellow number two is them leaving Mount Sinai, which we just read about, and they have now come to Hazeroth, and they are on their way to Kadesh Barnea, which is the border of the Promised Land. If you look at the little number two that kind of goes out and comes back, that's representing the 12 spies that will go into the land and bring back the report. The green number three represents them wandering in the wilderness for some 40 years. And then the purple number four represents them ultimately finally coming into the Promised Land under the leadership of Joshua. So it gives us a general idea of what took place and also where they went. And so that brings us into chapter 12, where we have Miriam and Aaron. And then this is Moses' older brother and older sister complaining. It says in chapter 12, verse 1, then Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses because of the Ethiopian woman whom he had married, for he had married an Ethiopian woman. So they said, has the Lord indeed spoken only through Moses? Has he not spoken through us also? And the Lord heard it. Now, as they complain against Moses, against the Ethiopian woman, it might be Zipporah. It might be the one that he married when he left Egypt. And if you remember, when he was called by God, burning bush passage, and he came back to Egypt to set the people free, on their journey back, at one point he sent Zipporah and the kids back home to her father. Now, after he's brought Israel out of Egypt and he's come to Mount Sinai, his father-in-law has brought his wife to them. I don't think the issue is so much that she's an Ethiopian woman. I think the issue is more of envy, because you can see their response. You know, hasn't God spoken through us too? And maybe it's Miriam. Why Miriam? Because Miriam is the one who gets the brunt of the judgment in chapter 12. Maybe this extra female figure was not a good thing in her eyes. I don't know. But the bottom line is God judged Miriam for it, and she was struck with leprosy. Moses interceded for Miriam, and God ultimately did heal her. And that takes us to the end of chapter 12, where it says in verse 16, and afterward the people moved from Hazeroth and camped in the wilderness of Paran. And that basically takes us up to the border of the Promised Land and into chapter 13. Chapter 13, the spies are sent into the land. Chapter 13, beginning from verse 1, it says, and the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, send men to spy out the land of Canaan, which I am giving to the children of Israel. From each tribe of their fathers, you shall send a man, everyone a leader among them. So Moses sent them from the wilderness of Paran, according to the command of the Lord, all of them men who were heads of the children of Israel. And then he begins to name the 12 men who will go, one representing each tribe that will go in and spy out the land. Now, For those of you who don't know the story, these 12 spies are going to go into the land. They're going to spy it out. They're going to admit, man, this is a great place to go, but there's a lot of people in there, and some of them are really big, and we don't think we can go and overtake them. And so they come back and they give a negative report. And yet we look at chapter 13, and the Lord is the one who's commanding these spies to go in and spy out the land and then come back and give word. However, we have another passage in Deuteronomy chapter 1 that I'd like you to turn to right now. It's the next book up after Numbers, Deuteronomy chapter 1, where we see Moses rehearsing to the next generation what actually transpired when these spies were going to be sent into the promised land. If you turn to Deuteronomy chapter 1, verse 19, again, this is Moses speaking to the next generation some 40 years later and rehearsing what had taken place at the moment we're looking at in Numbers. Deuteronomy 1:19, so we departed from Horeb, that's another word for Mount Sinai, and went through all that great and terrible wilderness which you saw on the way to the mountains of the Amorites, as the Lord our God had commanded us. Then we came to Kadesh Barnea, the border of the promised land. And I said to you, you have come to the mountains of the Amorites, which the Lord our God is giving us. Look, the Lord your God has set the land before you. Go up and possess it as the Lord God of your fathers has spoken to you. Do not fear or be discouraged. And every one of you came near to me and said, let us send men before us and let them search out the land for us and bring back word to us of the way by which we should go up and of the cities into which we shall come. The plan pleased me well, so I took 12 of your men, one man from each tribe. So we get a little more details into what really happened. Moses said, go. The Lord said he would give you the land, so just go. And then they came to Moses and said, you know what? Let's go take a look-see first and just see what it's like. And Moses is like, well, maybe that's not a bad idea. I think if they had just initially gone, and this is going to be the key when we come to the end of this tonight, if they would have just took God at his word and trusted him, and gone into the land and go, God said, this is for us. We're going to go in and we're going to possess it. Then they would have possessed the land. How do I know that? Because we see that under Joshua, when Joshua would take the next generation into the land. And so God, I guess you look at it maybe as God's permissive will. Okay, not his perfect will, but his permissive will, what he allowed them to go ahead and do. And so back in Numbers 13, we see the leaders of the 12 tribes, the ones that would go in as spies from each tribe. And I just wanted to point out in verse 6 of Numbers 13, it says, from the tribe of Judah, Caleb, the son of Jephunneh. And also in verse 8, it says, from the tribe of Ephraim, Hoshea, the son of Nun. Now, who is Hoshea? Jump to verse 16 of chapter 13. It says, these are the names of the men whom Moses sent to spy out the land. And Moses called Hoshea, the son of Nun, Joshua. So we see that Caleb and Joshua were two of the spies that went into the land to spy it out. Verse 17, Moses gives them the direction. Then Moses sent them to spy out the land of Canaan and said to them, go up this way into the south and go up to the mountains and so forth. He tells them where to go and all. And then in verse 21, it says, so they went up and spied out the land from the wilderness of Zin as far as Rehob near the entrance of Hamath. And they went up through the south and came to Hebron, Ahiam, and all these other places that I can't pronounce. And then verse 23, then they came to the valley of Eshcol and there cut down a branch with one cluster of grapes. They carried it between two of them on a pole. That's some big grapes, right? I mean, it's not like I'll put this cluster in my backpack. This is let's two of us carry this thing, you know? And it's just a picture of a land flowing with milk and honey. This is the fruitful land that God had for them. In fact, that image of the two spies carrying this cluster of grapes is still the image for the ministry of tourism in Israel today, to say that they are a land that is abundant in resources and all. So kind of cool. So anyway, they go into the land and they spy out the land, and then we see them coming back in verse 26. It says, now they departed and came back to Moses and Aaron and all the congregation of the children of Israel in the wilderness of Paran at Kadesh. They brought back word to them and to all the congregation and showed them the fruit of the land. Then they told him and said, "We went to the land where you sent us. It truly flows with milk and honey, and this is its fruit. Nevertheless, the people who dwell in the land are strong. The cities are fortified and very large. Moreover, we saw the descendants of Anak there. The Amalekites dwell in the land of the south. The Hittites, the Jebusites, and the Amorites dwell in the mountains. And the Canaanites dwell by the sea and along the banks of the Jordan." Then Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, "Let us go up at once and take possession, for we are well able to overcome it." But the men who had gone up with him said, "We're not able to go up against the people, for they are stronger than we." And they gave the children of Israel a bad report of the land which they had spied out, saying, "The land through which we have gone as spies is a land that devours its inhabitants. And all the people whom we saw in it are men of great stature. There we saw the giants." The descendants of Anak came from the giants. "And we were like grasshoppers in our own sight, and so we were in their sight." See, the difference between Caleb and the other spies is Caleb is looking through the lens of faith, the lens of the supernatural. God said we could take it. If God's on our side, it's ours. And the other people were looking at it through the lens of the natural. In ourselves, there's no way we can do that. You know, I mean, we're learning the history of ancient Israel, but this is applicable to us today as well. Because we face our own giants, you know, and there's times when we look at things and admittedly, they're just too big for us to handle. But if God is for us, nothing can be against us, you know, and if God is leading us to do something, to go somewhere, to be a light in a dark world, to be an influence in the world and not be influenced by the world, even though it's too big for us as individuals, with God leading us, nothing is impossible. And so this isn't just an ancient history lesson. This is applicable to the people of God, for the people of God today. Amen? And so a great word that we can get encouragement by. Notice how the negative outlook so influenced the nation, the rest of the people. Chapter 14. "So all the congregation lifted up their voices and cried, and the people wept that night. And all the children of Israel complained against Moses and Aaron. And the whole congregation said to them, 'If only we had died in the land of Egypt, or if only we had died in this wilderness.'" Be careful what you ask for. Verse 3, "Why has the Lord brought us to this land? To fall by the sword, that our wives and children should become victims? Would it not be better for us to return to Egypt?" So they said to one another, "Let us select a leader and return to Egypt." Then Moses and Aaron fell on their faces before all the assembly of the congregation of the children of Israel. And so, you know, in one sense, you can understand the disappointment of the people as they're facing insurmountable difficulties. I mean, to them, there's just no way. We've got here and we're going to be doomed. We're going to be killed. Our wives, our children, we're done. It says in Proverbs chapter 13, verse 12, "Hope deferred makes the heart sick." So they've been longing for this land flowing with milk and honey, and now it's just not going to happen. And so they begin to complain. "Let's get a leader and let's go back to Egypt." They so quickly forget what it was like in Egypt. In verse 6, "But Joshua, the son of Nun, and Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, who were among those who had spied out the land, tore their clothes. And they spoke to all the congregation of the children of Israel, saying, 'The land we passed through to spy out is an exceedingly good land. If the Lord delights in us, then he will bring us into this land and give it to us, a land which flows with milk and honey. Only do not rebel against the Lord, nor fear the people of the land, for they are our bread. Their protection has departed from them, and the Lord is with us. Do not fear them.' And all the congregation said to stone them with stones. Now the glory of the Lord appeared in the tabernacle of meeting before all the children of Israel." And so we see Joshua trying to convince them otherwise. And now the Lord appears and he wants to basically wipe them out, you know. And Moses again comes and he intercedes for the people. But as God would say, that generation would miss out on what God had promised them. as we read in verse 26 of chapter 14, the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, "How long shall I bear with this evil congregation who complain against me? I have heard the complaints which the children of Israel make against me. Say to them, 'As I live, says the Lord, just as you have spoken in my hearing, so I will do to you. The carcasses of you who have complained against me shall fall in this wilderness. All of you who were numbered according to your entire number from 20 years old and above, except for Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, and Joshua, the son of Nun, you shall by no means enter the land which I swore I would make you dwell in. But your little ones, whom you said would be victims, I will bring in, and they shall know the land which you have despised. But as for you, your carcasses shall fall in this wilderness, and your sons shall be shepherds in the wilderness 40 years and bear the brunt of your infidelity until your carcasses are consumed in the wilderness. According to the number of the days in which you spied out the land, 40 days, for each day you shall bear your guilt 1 year, namely 40 years, and you shall know my rejection. I, the Lord, have spoken this. I will surely do so to all this evil congregation who are gathered together against me. In this wilderness they shall be consumed, and there they shall die." And so this generation, numbered from 20 years old and above, would end up dying in the wilderness, marching for 40 years until every last one of them died off. The longest funeral march in history. And think about it, though. The kids that are 19, I mean, that's not that young, okay? 19 and under, they would bear the brunt of their parents' sin. You know what? Because they would have to wander for 40 years in the wilderness. They would get to go into the promised land under Joshua, but they had to suffer because of their parents' sin. The same thing is true today as well. Parents, we have such a positive influence on our kids, and we can also have such a negative influence on our kids. And they oftentimes can suffer the brunt of our sin. And so it's such, I mean, when you go through the scriptures, you see that sin affects more than just yourself. It's far-reaching in the family, to the kids, to the community, the witness, and so forth. And so, oh, if we would just think twice before we would do the things that we do. And so they'll end up perishing in the wilderness. As we would close out the chapter in chapter 14, we would see the 10 spies would die of a plague immediately. And then, you know, these guys have a futile invasion attempt. They hear Moses say, "Okay, you guys are going to die in the wilderness." Like, "Oh, we'll go up now. We'll go fight against him now. We'll trust the Lord." And Moses is saying, "Don't do it. God's not with you." But they go anyway. And they go and fight, and they get wiped out. You know, the ones that go up and fight, because God had already decreed this is what's going to happen. What is this? This is an opportunity that was lost. They had the opportunity to go into the land that God had promised them. He'd brought them out of bondage in Egypt. It's an 11-day journey from Mount Sinai to the border of the promised land. They would never see the promised land. And those 19 and under would have to wander for 40 years until they finally came into that. An opportunity God set before them, an opportunity that they had to enter into through faith. But because they didn't believe, and that's the message that we're left with tonight, because they didn't believe, they wouldn't have what God had promised them. You know, the author of the book of Hebrews uses this same account as he's writing to them concerning salvation in Jesus. And that is so totally true. God has made salvation this wonderful opportunity possible for everybody, but there are those who don't take advantage of it, and so they miss that opportunity. But I think it goes beyond salvation. So I think it's applicable for us as Christians as well, not just salvation, but also our walk with the Lord or sanctification. I think the Lord wants us to live in victory. I think he has victorious lives for all of us, you know, as we follow him, but as we follow him in faith. As we have those things presented to us that we go, "Ooh, I don't know. I'm afraid to try that." God can come, if he's leading us, can come and give us everything we need to be able to succeed. We'll close with these verses from Hebrews. Hebrews chapter 3, verses 7 through 11. It says, "Therefore, as the Holy Spirit says, today if you will hear his voice, Do not harden your hearts as in the rebellion in the day of trial in the wilderness, where your fathers tested me, tried me, and saw my works 40 years. Therefore, I was angry with that generation and said, they always go astray in their heart, and they have not known my ways. So I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest. Now, the ultimate rest that he's talking about is salvation in Jesus, okay? But for the Christian, I think the application would be the victorious Christian life that he has for us if we will but walk by faith. Amen? All right. Next week, we'll finish out the book of Numbers, Lord willing, as they finish out their wanderings in the wilderness. Why don't we go ahead and pray, and we'll open it up for questions and comments. Our Heavenly Father, we want to thank you for your word, and we want to thank you that you have prepared the way for each one. And Lord, we recognize that as we follow you, there is nothing that is impossible. I pray that you will help us as you lay out those ventures of faith in front of us to walk through those doors and watch you be glorified. Lord, I pray that you would guard us against that temptation to be in control of every single situation or to manipulate so that we can try and make things work. It just seems like when we do that, you don't get the glory for it. If anything takes place, we seem to take the glory for ourselves. But when we just go into the midst of the lion's den, so to speak, or when we go up against giants like Goliath and trust in your name, then you are glorified, because there's no way that we can have victory in situations like that unless you are the one that empowers us and guides us, Lord. Thank you for your love and for your promise that you give us in your word. Please bless those that have come out, I pray in Jesus' name. Amen.